Well, some of you have been kidding me about here we are 3 weeks in and we're not even into the Sermon on the Mount yet. And I know that you've been kidding me about that a little bit. But the truth is, you know, we could have just started on week one with, okay, verse one, here we go. Let's study this and see what it says. And we would have maybe gotten something out of it. But I really believe we needed the last two Wednesday nights to really set the stage for where we're going. I think and I hope we can all appreciate what we've uncovered the last couple of Wednesday nights to really give meaning to what we're going to talk about now that we're getting into the actual Sermon on the Mount. So I hope you see that what we've been doing the last couple of weeks is not spinning wheels. We've been really laying that groundwork that needs to be laid so that we can get where we're going. I'm going to just show you these pictures and let the pictures do the talking because you've seen them and you know what they mean. And so let's look at this one. We've been talking about it. I've been putting it up here each week. So, at this point, I don't need to say once again and spend 5 minutes on what the window is. You've seen it, you know it, and so all we got to do is put it up there, and that image should spark something for you. The next one that I want to show you is this quote. It's actually not a quote. I wrote it. It's a quote for me, I guess. But it just kind of encapsulates where we've been and where we're going and the whole big picture of the Sermon on the Mount. And I'm not going to read it again, but it's there, and it continues to kind of give the direction that we need for the Sermon on the Mount. So we have that. And then the next one I want to show you, just this timeline, very simple, just kind of, once again, just seeing it should remind us of the big picture on this of the Sermon on the Mount. And really not just the big picture of the Sermon on the Mount, this is the big picture of all of history, right? This is what God is up to in all of history. And so we're just reminded of what the Sermon on the Mount is doing and the role it plays in that. Last week, we looked at these classes, and we talked about that line is right in the middle. You've got kind of the upper classes, and you've got the underclasses. This was the class system in Jesus' day, and unlike 21st century USA, there's no climbing this ladder. Now, it's really hard for us to really envision that, because we live in a democracy, a free country, the American dream, so many of us and our parents. You think about where especially some of our parents were and where they came to, and some of you who are here, and that's part of the beautiful thing about our country. But one of the things we need to remember is that most countries around the world are not like that today and have not been like that throughout history. You are where you are. And there's no moving, there's no climbing, there's no changing. You're stuck in the, I'm going to call it the sin-sick status quo. That's what it was. This was the sin-sick status quo of Jesus' culture. And the upper classes held on to. Those top two classes, which was 1% of the population, had up to 75% of the wealth. Okay. 1% of the population, 75% of the wealth. And so you see this system. I'm going to quote Jan Troxell, the great theologian Jan Troxell, here for just a minute. She told me on a great little image last Sunday. She said that she went to the movies in California, and that they had this whole system in place where you had to get them in advance, and once you get there, you touch the screen to figure out what seat you're going to get and all that. It's not like the Mighty Gay. You just walk up and, you know, Mr. Flexer's there and waves you in and get your ticket, and you go and you find your... It's not like that. It's this whole complicated system that you got to learn. And Jan said that there was a sign there over the counter that said something like this: if you don't know the system won't work for you. Is that what it said? Okay. If you don't know the system won't work for you. Okay? That's very friendly, isn't it? Yeah. And this was the system in Jesus' day. It was the way it was. And everybody knew the system. Everybody knew the system. And it worked for the people at the top. And it worked against those at the bottom. And for the ones in the middle, for the retainer class, merchant class, landowners, for them, the system worked for them just enough, just to give them a little bit of money, just enough to keep them calm. It worked for them just enough. One of the things that I shared with you last week is that often quoted saying, very true, history is written by the winners. You study history, you find that out to be true. History is always recorded by, written by the winners. And it just makes sense. You look back over history, you think about this, for example, the history of slavery in the United States. That account of history wasn't written by the slaves, right? What made it into our textbooks and our schools basically came from the white landowners. History is never written from the underside. It's never recorded from the underside. The people who win are the ones who get to tell the story. And that's how it's always happened throughout history. It's just the way that it goes. The Bible's different, though. The Bible's different. There are so many things about the Bible that make it different from other pieces of literature, from other accounts of history, from other tellings of the way things are. And one of the things that sets the Bible apart is that it wasn't written by the winners. And for people who know the Bible and love the Bible and read the Bible and understand the Bible and follow the Bible, it's important that we get that, because it's radically different from all the other accounts of history. Because the Bible was recorded by, written by, oppressed slaves, and in the New Testament, the persecuted church. The Bible came from the underside of history, which is, I mean, it's unheard of. It's unheard of. The Bible is really different in that way. It is a history from the underside. And so the Bible is resistance literature. The Sermon on the Mount is resistance literature. And what it's doing is resisting the sin sick status quo, the way that things are, the upside down world, the brokenness, the evil, the violence, the world that people call the real world that we all have to get used to, the ugliness of the world the way it is. What the Bible in general, but the Sermon on the Mount in particular, is doing is refusing the system, is refusing to accept the world the way it is, broken as it is, and presenting for us another way to be able to live. Well, we talked about, and let's look at the first couple of verses. We just dipped our toes in the water last week. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain. After he sat down, his disciples came to him. Then he began to speak, and he taught them, saying, why did Jesus go up the mountain? All right, I'll do last week over again. Yeah, Moses was the deliverer. Jesus saying, Jesus going up the mountain, I'm the deliverer. Moses brought the first covenant. Jesus going up the mountain saying, I'm bringing a new covenant. Moses brought the law written on stone. And the writer of Hebrews says, Jesus has come to write the law of God on our hearts. Moses was God's instrument for salvation for the people. And by going up the mountain, Jesus is letting them know, I am God's instrument for salvation for all of humanity. And so before Jesus even says one word, he's speaking volumes by going up this mountain. It's more than just so they can hear him. It's so much more than that. Okay, so who was there? It's important for a preacher to know their audience. You got to know your audience. Who's the congregation for this sermon? Who was listening to this Sermon on the Mount that Jesus was preaching? Who was there? Somebody know? The sick, the bottom rungs of the class system, a lot of the peasant class. If you read up until chapter 5, the crowds have been following him, witnessing his healings and the work that he had been doing, and those are the people, those needy people flocking to him. Good. Anybody else? His disciples were there, right? The crowds, mostly the peasant class. That's who was there. So I say that because it's important. to understand that it matters who a preacher's congregation is. And so when we read the Sermon on the Mount, when we look through it here, we got to keep in mind who Jesus is preaching to, okay? Because that's going to matter significantly. This wasn't just a sermon in a vacuum that just went out there, you know, but this was to these people, to these specific people, the bottom rungs of the ladder, okay? Jesus begins, let me back up and say this too. Sometimes people say, preachers, people, all kinds of people say, well, when we encounter one of Jesus' kind of hard sayings, the harsh, you know, we're tempted to say, well, what Jesus really meant was, soften Jesus up a little bit. Take the edge off of Jesus, right? What Jesus really meant was, he really didn't mean it like that, you know, that we're supposed to do that, or he didn't mean it. No, we tend to just kind of soften him up a little bit, domesticate Jesus a little bit. And I'm not interested in us doing that, okay? I want us to hear what Jesus is saying, even and especially when it doesn't go down easy, okay? So here we go. Jesus began with the Beatitudes. Now, you can find them in your Bible, verses 3 to 12, Matthew 5, 3 to 12. If you have a Bible in the chair near you, you can turn straight to page 1505, and we're going to start there in just a minute. I'm going to read it in just a minute, but before we read it, I want to tell you what Beatitudes were, because a Beatitude was a thing before Jesus spoke them, okay? It was a literary device. It was a thing before Jesus said them. So it's important to know what a Beatitude was. Beatitudes were statements of blessing. Okay, of course, you kind of get that from blessed are, blessed are, blessed are, right? They're statements of blessing. Up until Jesus' day, Beatitudes were common sayings. They were kind of like proverbs. They were little pithy types of statements. They were, you might call them cliche types of statements, dropped into conversation here and there. They begin with blessed are, and then you just fill in the blank with who is blessed. What Beatitudes were a declaration of privilege. You're saying who is privileged. You were stating who is favored by God. And really, they were stating the obvious. Up until Jesus' day, these Beatitudes, they just stated the obvious about who, obviously we have eyes and ears and we can tell who the blessed people are. And so the Beatitudes sounded like this. These are the Beatitudes that people heard leading up to Jesus' day. And Jesus heard some of these. They sounded something like, blessed are the wealthy, for they don't want for anything. Blessed are our rulers, for they have immense power over people. Blessed are those with radiant beauty, for they will be adored by the masses. He's just stating the obvious. These are the blessed people. It's obvious. You see them, you know them, you come in contact with them. Obviously, they're blessed people. Blessed are the mothers of many children, and especially sons in those days. For your homes are full, your days are good. Blessed are Olympic athletes, great competitors with chiseled bodies, for they are victorious over their adversaries. Blessed are mighty armies, for they cause nations to fall. Blessed are the young and healthy, for long and happy are their lives. Those were the types of Beatitudes, the statements of blessing, just stating the obvious about who's blessed. They really went without saying. Those were the blessed people. I mean, everybody could tell. They were like pearls of wisdom. They were just kind of, this is the way the world works. This is how life is. These are the blessed people. It went without saying, but people said them anyway. These are the people that God obviously smiles upon, is what people said, right? Proof is in the pudding. Evidence is clear. We all see it. We all know it. Jesus heard those types of Beatitudes growing up. Blessed are, blessed are, blessed are the wealthy, the powerful, the mighty, the handsome, the healthy, the all that kind of stuff. Jesus himself heard those. Everybody in Jesus' day, everybody heard them. They were dropped into conversation at dinner tables or on the road as people were traveling. Jesus heard many a sentence that began with blessed are, and the sentence was always finished with, you fill in the blank with those who had things going for them. Blessed are declarations of privilege. Just kind of stating who's favored by God. Today, those types of Beatitudes might sound something like this. Blessed are the CEOs of Fortune 500 companies who make 400 times what their workers earn. Blessed are the fat cats who blow millions on a few seconds for a Super Bowl commercial. Blessed are those who walk the red carpet with flash bulbs going off in their faces. Blessed are the athletes and the team owners who have money pouring out of their ears. Blessed are the Wall Street types, the power brokers, the self-sufficient, the ladder climbers. Basically, blessed are the winners. Blessed are the winners. That's what those types of beatitudes would sound like today. It just made sense. It was obvious. Those are the blessed people. So everybody in Jesus' day, before he begins this sermon, they had in their heads this notion of what a beatitude is. They just knew. It's a statement of favor, stating the obvious. So Jesus begins his sermon. He begins his sermon to these, remember, it matters who he's speaking to, right? He's not just speaking to anybody or nobody. He's speaking to these people. He says, blessed are, and there's this big pause. And I want you to feel this moment because the air lets out of the balloon. Put yourself in the shoes of these masses of people, bottom of the ladder. They know what beatitudes are. They've heard them their whole lives. They're sick of them. They've been knocked down by them so many times. Here's Jesus doing so much, and they flock to him. They're hearing him. They're seeing good things. And Jesus' first words of the Sermon on the Mount are, blessed are. And if you're one of these people, the diseased, the desperate, the demon-possessed, if you're one of these people, you've heard this kind of stuff your whole life, and you already know who the blessed people are. And you know that it's not you. And so you say to yourself, we know where he's going with this. He's going to tell us who's blessed, and we know who's blessed, and we know that it's not us. Smiles fall to frowns. I imagine some people probably even turn to start walking away. We've heard this our whole lives. But Jesus continues. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. So these people who had all these notions of what beatitudes were, and Jesus says this, and they turn to each other and they say, that's us that he's talking about. We're blessed. We've never been called blessed before. Never heard that before. Has Jesus been in the sun too long? Does Jesus know who he's talking to? That was how the Beatitudes landed. That was the whole context for speaking these Beatitudes. Now, I've got to confess to you, it's kind of embarrassing to say this. I used to think that a Beatitude was B-attitude. I used to think that a point of a Beatitude was to say, be this way, have this attitude. I used to think that's what it meant, because you just break that word down. I used to think that the Beatitudes were a prescription. You know what I mean by prescription? Prescribing a way, do this, prescribing an attitude, a way to be, a way to live, do this. And if you do this, you will be blessed. That's what I used to think Beatitudes were. And I've heard it preached and taught that way many times before. Be meek, be a peacemaker. It's a prescription for you to do this. Live this way and you're going to be blessed if you do this. One of the most important things to understand about the Beatitudes is that they are not prescriptive. They are descriptive, okay? They're not prescribing us a way to live, but they're describing life in the kingdom, okay? That's critical to understanding really where Jesus is going here. The Beatitudes that existed before Jesus spoke these, they weren't prescriptive. No, they weren't saying try to be healthy or try to be wealthy or try to be a certain way or try to be an Olympic athlete. They weren't prescribing anything. They're just describing life the way it is and stating the obvious as who's blessed. And in the very same way, when we approach the Beatitudes, it's important to understand that they're not prescriptive. They're not telling us how to be blessed. They're not telling us to be this way. But instead, they're just describing life in the kingdom, stating who the blessed people are. And so it's important that we get that. They're not how-tos. They're just describing life in the kingdom of heaven and how radically different it is from the world that we live in. So what Jesus is saying is, in my kingdom, in the kingdom of heaven, which really is right side up, it's right side up that runs counter to this world that is upside down. Jesus says, in my kingdom, the last are first, the humble are exalted. This is just the way that it is in my kingdom, Jesus says. These types of people that I'm describing to you, these are the VIPs, these people who he's speaking to. He says, you are the VIPs. These are the privileged ones. Like it or not, understand it or not, believe it or not, agree with it or not, these are the people, Jesus says, who have my heart. These are the people who have my heart. My kingdom is open to, my kingdom is for these people. Pretty wild stuff if you think about it. So let's look at them one by one. We'll just kind of move through them. Here we go. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, poor in spirit is not just poor financially, but it does include being poor financially. Poor all the way around. Poor in every way, including financially. So blessed are the broke and the broken. Blessed are the unemployed and the underemployed. The poor in spirit are the people who've been crushed by the weight of the world, the swindled, the shoved aside, the replaced. Simon and Garfunkel had a song, the sat upon, the spatted on, and the ratted on. Some of you might remember that. Blessed are the flunkouts, the burnouts, the dropouts, all those kinds of people. Blessed are wives who cover their bruises with makeup. Blessed are the elderly who choose between prescriptions and groceries. Blessed are those around the world, the many around the world who go to bed with empty bellies. Blessed are the unclean and the expendable, the lonely, the abused, the unloved, the pushed aside, the cast aside. Those were the people who were poor in spirit. And Jesus says, in my kingdom, you have God's heart. The kingdom's for you. You're favored. And notice, it's in the present tense. Blessed are. Not, you will be blessed one day. You will be blessed one day in heaven at the end of time, at the new creation. You'll be blessed one day. Don't worry. Just hold on. No, you're blessed now. Why? Because the kingdom has come now. The kingdom is broken in this world. The red carpet has been rolled out for you. You are the VIPs in my kingdom. The next one is blessed are the mourn. Now, in Greek, the word mourn, it's really stronger than we have it in the English. Maybe a very accurate way to say this is blessed are those who've been knocked down by grief. Knocked down by grief. Okay. In those days, widows, their only way of care, their only way of protection, their only way of provision, their only way of owning land or having anything was by way of their husband, because women weren't citizens. They couldn't own property. In fact, they were property. Women were property. And you were only as good as the husband you had, and you only had as much as the husband you had. And if your husband's gone, if you become a widow, you have nothing, no access to anything, no rights, nobody advocates for you, no property, no home, nothing. And that's why the Bible very strongly talks about taking care of the widow, because they have God's heart. So blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are couples whose tears fall into an empty crib. Blessed are moms and dads who have to purchase caskets the size of a bread box. Blessed is the woman who wraps herself in her dead husband's coat every night and cries herself to sleep so she can smell him. Blessed are those who've been racked with gut-wrenching grief. Blessed are those people. Blessed are those who mourn. Jesus said, if you're mourning, you're blessed. You're going to be comforted. You're blessed. Red carpet for you. You're VIP in my kingdom. Blessed are, the next one, the meek. Now, this word, we've taken this word and tried to make it mean different things. Meek isn't the same thing as humble. Try to be meek. That's not what this is. To be meek is to be subdued. It's to be extremely passive, lowly, spiritless. To be meek is to be tamed by the world, to be beaten down. Meek people, and you can call some to mind right now, people who never are able to look you in the eye. They're the people who just, they've gotten used to being pushed aside their whole lives. They've been taken advantage of, and everybody knows it. I think a good way to describe the meek is to say the bullied, okay? The people who've been bullied. There's a lot of bully language now in our schools and talking about. Blessed are the bullied. Blessed are the meek, those who've been pushed around to that point. Now, in those days, land was everything. You got land, you got something, right? You can farm the land, you can grow stuff, you can have a home, a future for your family. If you've got land, you've got a lot. If you've got land in Jesus' day, you can make a life for yourself. If you lived in Jesus' day, how did you get land? Somebody, how did you get land in Jesus' day? First century, how did you get land? That's one way to get it. How else do you get land? You don't have it. How do you get it? Your daddy didn't have it. How do you get land? You take it. You take it. You exert power. You use force. You push. You dominate. You bully. Who are the people in Jesus' day who had their land taken from them? The meek. And this is the great thing about it. This is what Jesus says. Blessed are the meek. People who've had their land pulled out from everything, just kind of pulled out, but particularly their land. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the whole earth. They're going to get all the land. Isn't that a beautiful way that Jesus says it? Blessed are those who've had their land pulled out from them, for they're going to get all the land. Your land has been taken away from you, and I give it all to you. Blessed are, the next one, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, or another word you could put in there is justice, for they're going to be filled. Now, this really does bring to mind the Old Testament prophets, because if anybody hungered and thirsted for righteousness, for justice, for the world to be made right again, it was the prophets, all of them, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Amos, Micah, that's what they talked about. That was the fire in their belly. That was the word from the Lord that God gave them about the way that we're taking care of the poor and the broken and the orphans and the widows and speaking out for justice in the world. The prophets over and over again said that. And so it's what they wanted. They wanted righteousness. They wanted justice for the world to be made right again, for this sin-sick world to stop having its way. And they did more than just want justice and righteousness. They hungered for it. They thirsted for it. And Jesus says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they're going to be filled. They're going to be filled with it. Blessed are the merciful, the next one. Now, blessed are those who show mercy. But the merciful, those who are mercy, you become merciful. Mercy is your energy. Blessed are those who don't live according to the ways of the world. And we talked about this in week one, how the world works. It's tit for tat. It's, hey, you hit me, I'm going to hit you back. And when I hit you back, I'm going to hit you harder than you hit me. And I'm not going to show you mercy because that's not the way that the world works. But the merciful respond with forgiveness, with grace, with mercy. Even and especially when you have every reason to punch back. With your fist or with your words, right? Even and especially when it's personal. You know, it's easy to talk about extending mercy in general. Yeah, we believe in mercy. We should always extend mercy to people. But when you talk about that specific joker who did that specific thing to me or to my family, come on. Then it hits home. It's hard to talk about really extending mercy. Blessed are the merciful, for they're going to be shown mercy. You know, the easy thing to do is not to show mercy, right? That's the easy thing to do. But it's not the kingdom thing to do. Mercy is a hallmark of the kingdom of God because mercy is one of the hallmarks of our God. Our God is merciful, right? And so blessed are the merciful, for they're going to be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart. Who is pure in heart? Who's pure in heart? You see anybody in here who's pure in heart? I'm coming up empty. How about you? Robin says kids. Anybody want to disagree with her? No? What's that? The very young. Yeah. James Cochran is pure in heart. Okay. Who else is pure in heart? Yes. Yes. The mentally disabled are pure in heart. Not me and not you. Defiled by sin, you know, we know that. If we are in any way pure in heart, it's because of God's grace and his transformation. It's not because we are to begin with, right? Blessed are the pure in heart because they can see God more clearly than we can. You see that about kids before they reach a certain age, right? Do you see that about the mentally disabled people you know? They have the simple faith, a way of seeing God more clearly than we can. They're blessed because they get to see God more clearly than we can see God. It's not tainted by that sin that we tend to live with. And right here at this point, you know, a lot of people take this as a prescription. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they're going to see God. So what you need to do is be pure in heart so you can be blessed. That's not so easy, is it? We can't just be pure in heart. And the point of it's not to tell us to try to be, but it's saying those people who are pure in heart, those are blessed people. Those are best. And I'm gonna add to that. This is kind of an aside. One particular theologian pastor says, if your church doesn't have at least one mentally challenged person in it, it's not a church. I love that. I love that because I think, you know, I think about the wonderful people we've had over these years and continue to have who are mentally disabled and our friends and the community. And I think, man, how much when we're around them, do they see God more clearly and how much do they teach us and how beautiful and wonderful that is. They see God more clearly than the rest of us do. That's just the truth. Not telling us to do anything about it or try to be that way. Just saying that's the truth. It's the way it is. They're favored. Next one, blessed are the peacemakers. Now, interestingly, this is the only place in the Bible that the word peacemaker is used. It's not used anywhere else. One who reconciles quarrels, one who brings wholeness and peace in relationships, one who makes peace in those settings. Folks, this is going to be one of those things that might rub you the wrong way a little bit, might not go down so easy, but we're not going to soften Jesus, okay? We're not going to say, well, what Jesus really meant was, but the truth is, if you look at Jesus here and in a number of encounters that he had and a number of teachings that he gave in the way that he lived his life, Jesus over and over and over again, like it or not, okay, he sends the message that violence is not the answer. Okay? This is one of those times. We're just taking him for what he says, right? Don't get mad at me. Jesus said it. Okay? Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are those who have the opportunity to fight, but instead they choose to make peace. Now, you can imagine that in Jesus' day, people who sought to make peace, they were probably called all kinds of things, right? They had names, they had labels. Loser, coward, sissy, chicken, right? Afraid. And there were probably names worse than that that I'm not going to say here. You don't want me to say here, right? There's probably all kinds of names that people who tried to make peace were called those names. Jesus says their name is going to be child of God. Their name, their label, their designation is child of God. That's their title. That's who they are. They're children of God because they're making peace in the name of God. Uh-huh. Big question, long answer, another time. Love you, brother. What we can say is this. We can say this. Something decidedly different happened with Jesus. Okay? Not to say that the God that we find in Jesus is inconsistent with the God of the Old Testament, but something significant happened in the person and the life of who Jesus Christ was. Yeah, yeah, and that's a big part of that. That's a big part of that. And so we look to him in that way. Not that we completely disregard any or every part of the Old Testament, but when in doubt, I think we really look to who Jesus was and the model that he gave, because Jesus is God's intention for how he wants humanity to be. And so I think that's a big part of it. There's a longer answer than that I'd love to get to. So no, you're fine. You're fine. It's a good question, important question. But at this point, Jesus isn't even telling us to make peace, okay? Because remember, it's not a prescription. It's a description. Those people who are out there making peace in the world, they're blessed. They're children of God. They're calling them all kinds of things, but I'm going to call them children of God, because they're making peace. So even at this point, we're not being told to do it. We're just saying those people who are doing it, they're the blessed ones. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness. Now, you think about the history of the Jewish people being persecuted. Persecution was happening in Jesus' day. And really, if you think about it, the other context of the Sermon on the Mount was when Matthew wrote it, decades after it happened, there was real intense persecution going on in Matthew's day. The church was being persecuted by Rome in that day. So when Matthew recorded it, you know Matthew wanted to make sure that this, especially this part, really got funneled to the people of his day. The people who were imprisoned, oppressed, violated, the people who are persecuted for their faith. And so you know, it still happens today around the world. And also, so you know, it's not us, okay? We're not persecuted. There is real persecution happening around the world today, and we're not being persecuted, okay? Sometimes I hear Christians talk about how here in our country, our rights are taken away, or this has happened, or we're it's not as much of a Christian nation as it used to be, or, you know, you hear that kind of stuff. That's not persecution, folks. Just because we're not getting our way in our country doesn't mean we're being persecuted, okay? And the truth is, that's insulting to the people who really are being persecuted. It is. Disrespectful to people who really are being persecuted around the world. Yeah, do we wish we maybe had more rights or that kind of stuff? Or do we wish, you know, it was more of a Christian nation? Like, sure, fine, wish for that all you want to. But it's not persecution. It's not persecution. Blessed are those who are persecuted for your faith. You're blessed. Yours is the kingdom of heaven. Then, the last, to end it up, Jesus says, just in case, remember who he's preaching to. Remember his audience, the peasant classes, the underclasses, just in case they're not getting it, just in case it's not landing. And Jesus has been so very clear. But just in case they're not getting it, Jesus, blessed are you. just in case the crowds missed the fact that he was talking about him, about them. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Great is your reward in heaven. You're like the prophets. You're in good company. You're in good company. So there you have the Beatitudes. The Beatitudes are so much more than gentle, cutesy, kind of sterile sayings that, you know, you embroider on a pillow or, you know, made into an elegant bookmark or a decorative wall hanging. Don't go take down your wall hangings. You don't have to do that. What I'm saying is they're more than just those sweet, sterile sayings that maybe we think that they are. And the Beatitudes are more than how-tos. They're not how-tos. They're not, if you do this, you'll be blessed. They're not formulas for getting blessed, which is how it's been preached a lot, I know. They're not prescriptive, they're descriptive. They're describing life in the kingdom of heaven. They are statements of God's favor. Jesus is saying, these are my people, you are my people, my VIPs, you are the ones I favor. You're the ones, roll the red carpet out for you. The kingdom of heaven is open to people like you. Jesus is saying loud and clear right here, the world has it wrong. The world has it wrong because the world has been turned upside down by sin. All the notions of power and might and favor and importance and wealth and status and all that stuff, all the blessed are's of the world, they have it wrong because it's a sin-sick system. It's broken. Jesus says, in my kingdom, these are the blessed ones. I heard a couple of amens a minute ago, so I think I just started preaching. In my kingdom, these are the blessed ones. You are the blessed ones. And the beautiful thing about it is Jesus didn't just pronounce blessings over them, but Jesus really blessed them with the way he treated them, didn't he? Right? He didn't just say that they were blessed, but he blessed them with his actions, with the way he treated them with dignity and love and respect and care. He actually did bless them with the way that he lived. And these Beatitudes are not talking about one day far off in the future when everything is made right. Blessed are you. Not blessed will you be, but blessed are you. Present tense. Why? Because my kingdom is here right now. My kingdom has entered into this world. It's breaking into this world. That crown is turning. It's turning. Or to use the other analogy, the train's pulled into the station. Still coming, but it's here. The kingdom's here. Describing life in the kingdom. So if these Beatitudes aren't prescriptive, if they're not telling us to do something, well, what are we supposed to do with them? Right? You're probably thinking that all along. Okay, they're not telling us to do something, so what do you do with these things? First, we don't see them as prescriptions. We see them as statements of favor and just deal with it, accept it the way it is. But secondly, the Beatitudes call us to see the world differently. Do you see that? You see that? They had Beatitudes that stated the world the way it was, upside down. The Beatitudes call us to see the world right side up, to look at the world through the lens of the Beatitudes, to recognize that the people who the world says are blessed, that's a lie. And to begin to envision a world that's different, different notion of blessed. So there's a warning in the Beatitudes. Don't buy into the world's notions of blessedness and greatness and favor. But instead, the Beatitudes give us kingdom eyes so that we can begin to see the world differently, because if you see the world differently, then you might just begin to live differently. The Beatitudes call us to see the world differently, because if you see the world differently, you might just begin to live differently. How crazy would that be if church people did that. You get the feeling you're being turned, everything's being turned, that crown is turning. It's like the world's kind of shifting under our feet. It's almost like here as we get deeper into the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is going to say, you have heard it said this, but I tell you this. You know that. Jesus says that a few times in the Sermon on the Mount. You've heard it said this, but I tell you this, right? We're going to get there when Jesus actually says that. But he's kind of saying it here. In the Beatitudes, Jesus is saying, you have heard it said that the blessed people are these kinds of people. But I'm telling you, that's a lie. These are the blessed people. These are the ones who my kingdom favors. See the world this way. And if you begin to see the world this way, then you might just begin to live differently. You might just begin to live your life not according to the world, but according to the kingdom of heaven. And so that's the call within the Beatitudes. I don't know about you. I grew up hearing Beatitudes taught and preached a certain way. And this is different for me to even think about them this way. So I suspect it is for a lot of us to think that it's radically different from maybe the ways that we've heard about them all along. Well, next week, we're going to talk about salt and light. So verses 13 to 16, salt and light. So next week has to be less intense, right? It's got to ease up a little bit for us. I mean, salt and light. What could be wild about that? What could be radical or crazy or unsettling? It's just salt and light. So next week we should be okay, I think. Lord, thank you for